Jeannie turned to her father. What happened?
I got time off for good behavior. I'm free. And naturally, the first thing I wanted was to see my little girl.
Right after you went on a 3-day drunk. He was so transparently insincere, it was offensive. She felt the familiar rage rise inside her. Why couldn't she have a father like other people's? He said, "Come on, be nice." Anger turned into sadness. She had never had a real father, and she never would. "Give me that bottle," she said. "I'll make coffee." Reluctantly, he handed her the vodka, and she put it back in the freezer. She put water in the coffee maker and turned it on.
"You look older," he said to her. "I see a little gray in your hair."
"Gee, thanks." She put out mugs, cream and sugar.
"Your mother went gray early.
I always thought you were the cause of that."
"I went to her place," he said in a tone of mild indignation. "She doesn't live there anymore."
"She's in Bella Vista now."
"That's what the neighbor told me, Mrs. Mendoza. She gave me your address." "I don't like to think of your mother in a place like that."
"Then take her out of there," Jeannie said indignantly. "She's still your wife. Get yourself a job and a decent apartment and start taking care of her."
"You know I can't do that. I never could."
"Then don't criticize me for not doing it." His tone became wheedling.
"I didn't say anything about you, honey. I just said I don't like to think of your mother in an institution, that's all."
"I don't like it either, nor does Patty. We're going to try to raise the money to get her out of there."
Jeannie felt a sudden surge of emotion, and she had to fight back tears.
"God damn it, Daddy, this is tough enough without having you sit there complaining." "Okay, okay," he said.
Jeannie swallowed hard. "I shouldn't let him get to me this way." She changed the subject.
"What are you going to do now? Do you have any plans?"
"I'll look around for a while. He meant he would scout for a place to rob." Jeannie said nothing. He was a thief, and she could not change him. He coughed.
"Maybe you could let me have a few bucks to get me started."
That made her mad again.
"I'll tell you what I'm going to do," she said in a tight voice. "I'll let you shower and shave while I put your clothes through the washer. If you keep your hands off that vodka bottle, I'll make you some eggs and toast. You can borrow some pajamas and sleep on my couch. But I'm not giving you any cash. I'm desperately trying to find the money to pay for Mom to stay someplace where they'll treat her like a human being, and I don't have a dollar to spare."
"Okay, sweetie," he said, putting on a martyred air.
"I understand."
She looked at him. In the end, when the turmoil of shame and anger and pity died down, all she felt was longing. She wished with all her heart that he could take care of himself, could stay in one place more than a few weeks, could hold down a normal job, could be loving and supportive and stable. She yearned for a father who would be a father, and she knew she would never, ever have her wish. There was a place in her heart for a father, and it would always be empty. The phone rang. Jeannie picked it up. "Hello?" It was Lisa, sounding upset.
"Jeannie, it was him."
"Who? What?"
"That guy they arrested with you. I picked him out of the lineup.
He's the one that raped me. Stephen Logan."
"He's the rapist?"
Jeannie said incredulously.
"Are you sure?"
"There's no doubt, Jeannie," Lisa said. "Oh, my God, it was horrible seeing his face again. I didn't say anything at first because he looked different with no hat. Then the detective made them all put on baseball caps, and I knew for certain sure."
"Lisa, it can't be him," Jeannie said.
"What do you mean?"
"His tests are all wrong, and I spent time with him. I have a feeling."
"But I recognized him."
Lisa sounded annoyed. "I'm amazed. I can't understand it. This spoils your theory, doesn't it? You wanted one twin to be good and the other bad."
"Yes, but one counterexample doesn't disprove a theory. I'm sorry if you feel your project is threatened by this.
That's not the reason I'm saying it's not him." Jeannie sighed.
"Hell,
Maybe it is. I don't know anymore. Where are you now?
At home.
Are you okay?
Yes, I'm fine, now that he's locked up in jail.
He seems so nice.
They're the worst kind, Mish told me. The ones that seem perfectly normal on the surface are the cleverest and most ruthless, and they enjoy making women suffer.
My God.
I'm going to bed. I'm exhausted. I just wanted to tell you. How was your evening?
So-so. I'll tell you all about it tomorrow.
I still want to go to Richmond with you.
Jeannie had planned to take Lisa to help her interview Dennis Pinker. Do you feel up to it?
Yes. I really want to go on living a normal life. I'm not sick. I don't need to convalesce.
Dennis Pinker will probably be Steve Logan's double.
I know. I can handle it.
If you're sure,
I'll call you early.
Okay. Good night.
Jeannie sat down heavily. Could Stephen's engaging nature be no more than a mask?
I must be a bad judge of character, if that's so, she thought. And maybe a bad scientist, too. Perhaps all identical twins will turn out to be identically criminal. She sighed. Her own criminal ancestry sat beside her. That professor is a nice-looking guy, but he must be older than me, he said. You having a thing with him or what?
Jeannie wrinkled her nose.
The bathroom's through there, Daddy, she said.
13.
Steve was back in the interrogation room with the yellow walls. The same two cigarette butts were still in the ashtray. The room had not changed, but he had. 3 hours ago, he had been a law-abiding citizen, innocent of any crime worse than driving at 60 in a 55 zone. Now he was a rapist, arrested and identified by the victim, and accused. He was in the justice machine, on the conveyor. He was a criminal. No matter how often he reminded himself that he had done nothing wrong, he could not shake the feeling of worthlessness and ignominy. Earlier, he had seen the woman detective, Sergeant Delaware. Now the other one, the man, came in, also carrying a blue folder. He was Steve's height, but much broader and heavier, with iron gray hair cut short and a bristling mustache. He sat down and took out a pack of cigarettes. Without speaking, he tapped out a cigarette, lit it, and dropped the match in the ashtray. Then he opened the folder. Inside was yet another form. This one was headed, District Court of Maryland, 4, City, County. The top half was divided into two columns, headed Complainant and Defendant. A little lower down it said, Statement of Charges. The detective began to fill out the form, still without speaking. When he had written a few words, he lifted the white top sheet and checked each of the 4 attached carbon copies, green, yellow, pink, and tan. Reading upside down, Steve saw that the victim's name was Lisa Margaret Hoxton. What's she like? He said. The detective looked at him. Shut the fuck up, he said. He drew on his cigarette and continued writing. Steve felt demeaned. The man was abusing him, and he was powerless to do anything about it. It was another stage in the process of humiliating him, making him feel insignificant and helpless. You bastard, he thought. I'd like to meet you outside of this building, without your damn gun. The detective began filling in the charges. In box number 1, he wrote, Sunday's date. Then, at Jones Falls University Gymnasium, Balto, M.D. Below, he wrote, rape, first degree. In the next box, he put the place and date again, then assault with intent to rape. He picked up a continuation sheet and added 2 more charges. Battery and sodomy. Sodomy? Steve said in surprise. Shut the fuck up. Steve was ready to punch him out. This is deliberate, he told himself. The guy wants to provoke me. If I throw a punch at him, he has an excuse to call 3 other guys in here to hold me down while he kicks the shit out of me. Don't do it. Don't do it. When he finished writing, the detective turned the 2 forms around and pushed them across the table at Steve. You're in bad trouble, Steve. You've beaten and raped and sodomized a girl. No, I haven't.
Shut the fuck up.
Steve bit his lip and remained silent. You're scum. You're shit. Decent people don't even want to be in the same room as you. You've beaten and raped and sodomized a girl. I know it's not the first time. You've been doing it a while. You're sly, and you plan. And you've always got away with it in the past. But this time you've been caught. Your victim has identified you. Other witnesses place you near the scene at the time. In an hour or so, just as soon as Sergeant Delaware has gotten a search or seizure warrant from the court commissioner on duty, we're going to take you over to Mercy Hospital and do a blood test and comb through your pubic hair and show that your DNA matches what we found in the victim's vagina. How long does that take, the DNA test? Shut the fuck up. You're nailed, Steve. Do you know what's going to happen to you? Steve said nothing. The penalty for first-degree rape is life imprisonment. You're going to jail. And you know what's going to happen there? You're going to get a taste of what you've been dishing out. A good-looking youngster like you? No problem. You're going to be beaten and raped and sodomized. You're going to find out how Lisa felt. Only in your case, it will go on for years and years and years. He paused, picked up the cigarette packet, and offered it to Steve. Surprised, Steve shook his head. By the way, I'm Detective Brian Alliston. He lit a cigarette. I really don't know why I'm telling you this, but there is a way you can make it better for yourself. Steve frowned, curious what was coming now. Detective Alliston got up, walked around the table, and sat on its edge, with one foot on the floor, intimately close to Steve. He leaned forward and spoke in a softer tone. Let me lay it out for you. Rape is vaginal intercourse, using force or the threat of force, against the will or without the consent of the woman. For it to be first-degree rape, there has to be an aggravating factor such as kidnapping, disfigurement, or rape by two or more persons. The penalties for second-degree rape are lower. Now, if you can persuade me that what you did was only second degree, you could do yourself a great big favor. Steve said nothing. Do you want to tell me how it happened? At last, Steve spoke. Shut the fuck up, he said. Alliston moved very fast. He came off the table, grabbed Steve by the front of his shirt, lifted him out of the chair, and slammed him against the cinder block wall. Steve's head jerked back and hit the wall with a painful bang. He froze, clenching his fists at his sides. Don't do it, he said to himself. Don't fight back. It was hard. Detective Alliston was overweight and out of condition, and Steve knew he could lay the bastard out in no time. But he had to control himself. All he had to hold on to was his innocence. If he beat up a cop, no matter how he had been provoked, he would be guilty of a crime. And then he might as well give up. He would lose heart if he did not have that sense of righteous indignation to buoy him up. So he stood there, rigid, his teeth clenched, while Alliston pulled him off the wall and slammed him back twice, three times, four times. Don't ever speak to me like that again, you punk, Alliston said. Steve felt his rage ebb away. Alliston was not even hurting him. This was theater, he realized. Alliston was acting a part. And doing it badly. He was the tough guy, and Mish was the nice one. In a while, she would come in and offer him coffee and pretend to be his friend. But she would have the same aim as Alliston, to persuade Steve to confess to the rape of a woman he had never met, called Lisa Margaret Hoxton. Let's cut the crap, detective, he said. I know you're a tough son of a bitch with hairs growing out of your nostrils, and you know that if we were somewhere else and you didn't have that gun on your belt, I could beat the shit out of you. So let's stop trying to prove ourselves. Alliston looked surprised. No doubt he had expected Steve to be too scared to speak. He let go of Steve's shirt front and walked to the door. They told me you were a smartass, he said. Well, let me tell you what I'm going to do for your education. You're going back to the cells for a while, but this time you'll have company. You see, all the 41 empty cells down there are somehow out of commission, so you're going to have to share with a guy called Rupert Butcher, known as Porky. You think you're a big motherfucker, but he's bigger. He's coming down from a 3-day crack party, so he has a headache. Last night, around the time you were setting fire to the gymnasium and sticking your nasty dick into poor Lisa Hoxton, Porky Butcher was stabbing his lover to death with a gardening fork. You should enjoy one another. Let's go. Steve was scared. All his courage ebbed away as if a plug had been pulled, and he felt defenseless and defeated. The detective had humiliated him without really threatening to hurt him badly. But a night with a psychopath was seriously dangerous. This Butcher character had already committed a murder. If he were capable of rational thought, he would know that he had little to lose by committing another. "Wait a minute," Steve said shakily. Alliston turned back slowly. "Well, if I confess, I get a cell to myself." Relief showed in the detective's expression. "Sure," he said. His voice had suddenly become friendly. The change of tone caused Steve to burn with resentment. "But if I don't, I get murdered by Porky Butcher." Alliston spread his hands in a helpless gesture. Steve felt his fear turn to hatred. "In that case, detective," he said, "fuck you." The surprised look came back into Alliston's face. "You bastard," he said. "We'll see if you're so goddamn feisty in another couple of hours. Come on." He took Steve to the elevator and escorted him to the cell block. Spike was still there. "Put this creep in with Porky," Alliston told him. Spike raised his eyebrows. "That bad, huh?" "Yeah. And by the way, Steve here has nightmares." "That's so. If you hear him cry out, don't worry about it. He's just dreaming." "I get you," Spike said. Alliston left, and Spike took Steve to his cell. Porky was lying on the bunk. He was about Steve's height, but a lot heavier. He looked like a bodybuilder who had been in a car wreck. His blood-stained T-shirt was stretched tight over bulging muscles. He lay on his back, head toward the rear of the cell, feet hanging over the end of the bunk. He opened his eyes when Spike unlocked the gate and let Steve in. It crashed shut, and Spike locked it. Porky opened his eyes and stared at Steve. Steve stared back for a moment. "Sweet dreams," Spike said. Porky closed his eyes again. Steve sat on the floor, with his back to the wall, and watched Porky sleep. 14. Barrington Jones drove home slowly. He felt disappointed and relieved at the same time, like a dieter who wrestles with temptation all the way to the ice cream parlor, then finds it closed. He had been saved from something he knew he ought not to do. He was no closer to solving the problem of Jeannie's project and what it might uncover, however. Maybe he should have spent more time questioning her and less having fun. He frowned in perplexity as he parked outside the house and went in. The place was quiet. Mary Ann, the housekeeper, must have gone to bed. He went into the den and checked his answering machine. There was one message. "Professor, this is Sergeant Delaware from the Sex Crimes Unit calling on Monday night. I appreciate your cooperation today." Barrington shrugged. He had done little more than confirm that Lisa Hoxton worked at Nuthouse. She went on. "As you are Ms. Hoxton's employer, and the rape took place on campus, I thought I should tell you we have arrested a man this evening. In fact, he was a subject at your laboratory today. His name is Stephen Logan."
"Jesus!"
Barrington burst out. "The victim picked him out at the lineup, so I'm sure the DNA test will confirm that he is the man. Please pass this information on to any others at the college whom you think appropriate." "Thank you."
"No!" Barrington said. He sat down heavily.
"No," he said more quietly.
Then he began to weep. After a moment, he got up, still crying, and closed the study door, for fear the maid might come in. Then he returned to his desk and buried his face in his hands. He stayed that way for some time. When at last the tears dried up, he lifted the phone and called a number he knew by heart. "Not the answering machine, please God," he said aloud as he listened to it ring out. A young man answered. "Hello?" "This is me," Farrington said. "Hey, how are you?" "Desolate." "Oh." The tone was guilty. If Farrington had any doubts, that note in the voice swept them away. "You know what I'm calling about, don't you? Tell me. Don't play games with me, please. I'm talking about Sunday night." The young man sighed. "Okay. You goddamn fool. You went to the campus, didn't you? You..." He realized he should not say too much on the phone. "You did it again." "I'm sorry." "You're sorry. How did you know?" "At first I didn't suspect you. I thought you'd left town. Then they arrested someone who looks just like you."
"Wow! That means I'm..."
"You're off the hook."
"Wow, what a break! Listen..."
"What?"
"You wouldn't say anything. To the police or anything."
"No, I won't say a word," Farrington said with a heavy heart. "You can rely on me." Tuesday. 15. The city of Richmond had an air of lost grandeur, and Jeannie thought Dennis Pinker's parents fit right in. Charlotte Pinker, a freckled redhead in a whispering silk dress, had the aura of a great Virginia lady, even though she lived in a frame house on a narrow lot. She said she was 55, but Jeannie guessed she was probably nearer 60. Her husband, whom she referred to as the Major, was about the same age, but he had the careless grooming and unhurried air of a man who had long retired. He winked roguishly at Jeannie and Lisa and said, "Would you girls like a cocktail?" His wife had a refined southern accent, and she spoke a little too loudly, as if she were perpetually addressing a meeting.
"For mercy's sake, Major, it's 10 o'clock in the morning."
He shrugged. "Just trying to get the party off to a good start."
"This is no party. These ladies are here to study us. It's because our son is a murderer."
She called him our son, Jeannie noted, but that did not mean a lot. He might still have been adopted. She was desperate to ask about Dennis Pinker's parentage. If the Pinkers admitted that he was adopted, that would solve half the puzzle. But she had to be careful. It was a delicate question. If she asked too abruptly, they were more likely to lie. She forced herself to wait for the right moment. She was also on tenterhooks about Dennis's appearance. Was he Stephen Logan's double or not? She looked eagerly at the photographs in cheap frames around the little living room. All had been taken years ago. Little Dennis was pictured in a stroller, riding a tricycle, dressed for baseball and shaking hands with Mickey Mouse in Disneyland. There were no pictures of him as an adult. No doubt the parents wanted to remember the innocent boy before he became a convicted murderer. In consequence, Jeannie learned nothing from the photographs. That fair-haired 12-year-old might now look exactly like Stephen Logan, but he could equally well have grown up ugly and stunted and dark. Both Charlotte and the Major had filled out several questionnaires in advance, and now they had to be interviewed for about an hour each. Lisa took the Major into the kitchen, and Jeannie interviewed Charlotte. Jeannie had trouble concentrating on the routine questions. Her mind kept wandering to Steve in jail. She still found it impossible to believe he could be a rapist. It was not just because that would spoil her theory. She liked the guy. He was smart and engaging, and he seemed kind. He also had a vulnerable side. His bafflement and distress at the news that he had a psychopathic twin had made her want to put her arms around him and comfort him. When she asked Charlotte if any other family members had ever been in trouble with the law, Charlotte turned her imperious gaze on Jeannie and drawled, "The men in my family have always been terribly violent." She breathed in through flared nostrils. "I'm a Marlowe by birth,
and we are a hot-blooded family. That suggested that Dennis was not adopted, or that his adoption was not acknowledged. Jeanne concealed her disappointment. Was Charlotte going to deny that Dennis could be a twin? The question had to be asked. Jeanne said, "Mrs. Pinker, is there any chance Dennis might have a twin?" "No." The response was flat. No indignation, no bluster, just factual. "You're sure?" Charlotte laughed. "My dear, that's one thing a mother could hardly make a mistake about. He definitely isn't adopted. I carried that boy in my womb. May God forgive me." Jeanne's spirits fell. Charlotte Pinker would lie more readily than Lorraine Logan, Jeanne judged, but all the same, it was strange and worrying that they should both deny their sons were twins. She felt pessimistic as they took their leave of the Pinkers. She had a feeling that when she met Dennis, she would find he looked nothing like Steve. Their rented Ford Aspire was parked outside. It was a hot day. Jeanne was wearing a sleeveless dress with a jacket over it, for authority. The Ford's air conditioner groaned and pumped out tepid air. She took off her pantyhose and hung her jacket on the rear seat coat hook. Jeanne drove. As they pulled onto the highway, heading for the prison, Lisa said, "It really bothers me that you think I picked the wrong guy." "It bothers me, too," Jeanne said. "I know you wouldn't have done it if you didn't feel sure." "How can you be so certain I'm wrong?" "I'm not certain about anything. I just have a strong feeling about Steve Logan." "It seems to me that you should weigh a feeling against an eyewitness certainty, and believe the eyewitness." "I know. But did you ever see that Alfred Hitchcock show? It's in black and white. You catch reruns sometimes on cable." "I know what you're going to say. The one where four people witness a road accident, and each one sees something different." "Are you offended?" Lisa sighed. "I ought to be, but I like you too much to be mad at you about it." Jeanne reached across and squeezed Lisa's hand. "Thanks." There was a long silence. Then Lisa said, "I hate it that people think I'm weak." Jeanne frowned.
"I don't think you're weak."
"Most people do. It's because I'm small, and I have a cute little nose and freckles."
"Well, you don't look tough, it's true."
"But I am. I live alone. I take care of myself. I hold down a job, and nobody fucks with me." "Or so I thought, before Sunday. Now I feel people are right. I am weak. I can't take care of myself at all. Any psychopath walking around the streets can grab me and hold a knife in my face and do what he wants with my body and leave his sperm inside me." Jeanne looked across at her. Lisa was white-faced with passion. Jeanne hoped it was doing her good to get these feelings out. "You're not weak," she said. "You're tough," Lisa said. "I have the opposite problem. People think I'm invulnerable."
"Because I'm 6 feet tall, and I have a pierced nostril and a bad attitude. They imagine I can't be hurt."
"You don't have a bad attitude." "I must be slipping." "Who thinks you're invulnerable?"
"I don't."
"The woman who runs the Bella Vista, the home my mom's in. She said to me, straight out, 'Your mother will never see 65. Just like that.
"I know you'd prefer me to be honest," she said. "I wanted to tell her that just because there's a ring in my nose, it doesn't mean I have no goddamn feelings."
"Mish Delaware says rapists aren't really interested in sex. What they enjoy is having power over a woman and dominating her and scaring her and hurting her. He picked someone who looked as if she would be easily frightened."
"Who wouldn't be frightened?"
"He didn't pick you, though. You probably would have slugged him."
"I'd like the chance."
"Anyway, you would have fought harder than I did, and you wouldn't have been helpless and terrified. So he didn't pick you." Jeanne saw where all this was heading. "Lisa, that may be true, but it doesn't make the rape your fault. Okay? You're not to blame. Not one iota. You were in a train wreck. It could have happened to anyone." "You're right," Lisa said. They drove 10 miles out of town and pulled off the interstate at a sign marked Greenwood Penitentiary. It was an old-fashioned prison, a cluster of gray stone buildings surrounded by high walls with razor wire. They left the car in the shade of a tree in the visitor's parking lot. Jeanne put her jacket back on, but left off her pantyhose. "Are you ready for this?" Jeanne said.
Dennis is going to look just like the guy who raped you, unless my methodology is all wrong. Lisa nodded grimly. I'm ready. The main gate opened to let out a delivery truck, and they walked in unchallenged. Security was not tight, Jeannie concluded, despite the razor wire. They were expected. A guard checked their identification and escorted them across a baking-hot courtyard, where a handful of young black men in prison fatigues were throwing a basketball. The administration building was air-conditioned. They were shown into the office of the warden, John Timoine. He wore a short-sleeved shirt and a tie, and there were cigar butts in his ashtray. Jeannie shook his hand. I'm Dr. Jean Ferrami from Jones Falls University. How are you, Jean? Timoine was obviously the type of man who found it hard to call a woman by her surname. Jeannie deliberately did not tell him Lisa's first name. And this is my assistant, Ms. Hoxton. Hi, honey. I explained our work when I wrote to you, Warden, but if you have any further questions, I'd be glad to answer them. Jeannie had to say that, even though she was itching to get a look at Dennis Pinker. You need to understand that Pinker is a violent and dangerous man, said Timoine. Do you know the details of his crime? I believe he attempted to sexually assault a woman in a movie theater and killed her when she tried to fight him off. You're close. It was at the old El Dorado movie theater down in Greensburg. They were all watching some horror movie. Pinker got into the basement and turned off the electric power. Then, while everyone was panicking in the dark, he ran around feeling girls up. Jeannie exchanged a startled look with Lisa. It was so similar to what had happened at JFU on Sunday. A diversion had created confusion and panic and given the perpetrator his opportunity. And there was a similar hint of adolescent fantasy about the two scenarios, feeling up all the girls in the darkened theater and seeing the women running naked out of the changing room. If Steve Logan was Dennis's identical twin, it seemed they had committed very similar crimes. Timoine went on. One woman unwisely tried to resist him, and he strangled her. Jeannie bridled. If he had felt you up, Warden, would you have unwisely tried to resist him? I ain't a girl, Timoine said, with the air of one who plays a winning card. Lisa tactfully intervened. We should get started, Dr. Ferrami. We have a lot of work to do. You're right. Timoine said, normally you would interview the prisoner through a grill. You've specially asked to be in the same room with him, and I have orders from above to let you. All the same, I urge you to think again. He is a violent and dangerous criminal. Jeannie felt a tremor of anxiety, but she stayed outwardly cool. There will be an armed guard in the room, all the time we're with Dennis. There sure will, but I'd be more comfortable if there was a steel mesh separating you from the prisoner. He gave a sickly grin. A man doesn't even have to be a psychopath to suffer temptation with two such attractive young girls. Jeannie stood up abruptly. I appreciate your concern, Warden. I really do. But we have to carry out certain procedures, such as taking a blood sample, photographing the subject, and so on, which can't be done through bars. Furthermore, parts of our interview are intimate, and we feel it would compromise our results to have such an artificial barrier between us and the subject. He shrugged. Well, I guess you'll be okay. He stood up. I'll walk you along to the cell block. They left the office and crossed a baked earth yard to a two-story concrete blockhouse. A guard opened an iron gate and let them in. The interior was as hot as the outside. Timoine said, Robinson here will take care of you from now on. Anything else you girls need, just holler. Thank you, Warden, Jeannie said. We appreciate your cooperation. Robinson was a reassuringly tall black man of about 30. He had a pistol in a buttoned holster and an intimidating-looking nightstick. He showed them into a small interview room with a table and half a dozen chairs in a stack. There was an ashtray on the table and a water cooler in the corner. Otherwise, the room was bare. The floor was tiled in gray plastic, and the walls were painted a similar shade. There was no window. Robinson said, Pinker will be here in a minute. He helped Jeannie and Lisa arrange the table and chairs. Then they sat down. A moment later, the door opened. 16. Barrington Jones met with Jim Proust and Preston Bark at the Monocle, a restaurant close to the Senate office building in Washington. It was a power lunch venue, full of people they knew, congressmen, political consultants, journalists, aides. Barrington had decided there was no point in trying to be discreet. They were too well known, especially Senator Proust with his bald head and big nose. If they had met in an obscure location, some reporter would have spotted them and written a gossip item, asking why they were holding secret meetings. Better to go where 30 people would recognize them and assume they were having a routine discussion about their legitimate mutual interests. Barrington's aim was to keep the Landsman deal on the rails. It had always been a risky venture, and Jeannie Ferrami had made it downright dangerous. But the alternative was to give up their dreams. There would be only one chance to turn America around and put her back on the course of racial integrity. It was not too late. Not quite. The vision of a law-abiding, church-going, family-oriented white America could be made a reality. But they were all around 60 years of age. They were not going to get another chance after this. Jim Proust was the big personality, loud and blustering, but although he often annoyed Barrington, he could usually be talked around. Mild-mannered Preston, much more likable, was also stubborn. Barrington had bad news for them, and he got it out of the way as soon as they had ordered. Jeannie Ferrami is in Richmond today, seeing Dennis Pinker. Jim scowled. Why the hell didn't you stop her? His voice was deep and harsh from years of barking orders. As always, Jim's overbearing manner irritated Barrington. What was I supposed to do? Tie her down? You're her boss, aren't you? It's a university, Jim. It's not the fucking army. Preston said nervously, Let's keep our voices down, fellas. He wore narrow glasses with a black frame. He had been wearing the same style since 1959, and Barrington had noticed that they were now coming back into fashion. We knew this might happen sometime. I say we take the initiative and confess everything right away. Confess? Jim said incredulously. Are we supposed to have done something wrong? It's the way people might see it. Let me remind you that when the CIA produced the report that started all this, New Developments in Soviet Science, President Nixon himself said it was the most alarming news to come out of Moscow since the Soviets split the atom. Preston said, The report may not have been true, but we thought it was. More important, our president believed it. Don't you remember how goddamn scary that was back then? Barrington certainly remembered. The Soviets had a breeding program for human beings, the CIA had said. They were planning to turn out perfect scientists, perfect chess players, perfect athletes, and perfect soldiers. Nixon had ordered the U.S. Army Medical Research Command, as it then was known, to set up a parallel program and find a way to breed perfect American soldiers. Jim Proust had been given the job of making it happen. He had come immediately to Barrington for help. A few years earlier, Barrington had shocked everyone, especially his wife Vivi, by joining the army just when anti-war sentiment was boiling up among Americans of his age. He had gone to work at Fort Detrick, in Frederick, Maryland, studying fatigue in soldiers. By the early 70s, he was the world's leading expert in the heritability of soldierly characteristics, such as aggression and stamina. Meanwhile, Preston, who had stayed at Harvard, had made a series of breakthroughs in understanding human fertilization. Barrington had talked him into leaving the university and becoming part of the great experiment with him and Proust. It had been Barrington's proudest moment. I also remember how exciting it was, he said. We were at the leading edge of science. We were setting America right, and our president had asked us to do this job for him. Preston toyed with his salad. Times have changed. It's no longer an excuse to say, I did it because the President of the United States asked me to. Men have gone to jail for doing what the President told them. What was wrong with it? Jim said testily. It was secret, sure, but what's to confess, for God's sake? We went undercover, Preston said.
Jim flushed beneath his tan.
We transferred our project into the private sector.
That was sophistry, Barrington thought, though he did not antagonize Jim by saying so. Those clowns from the committee to re-elect the president had got caught breaking into the Watergate Hotel, and all of Washington had run scared. Preston set up Genetico as a private limited corporation, and Jim gave it enough bread-and-butter military contracts to make it financially viable. After a while, the fertility clinics became so lucrative that its profits paid for the research program without help from the military. Barrington moved back into the academic world, and Jim went from the Army to the CIA and then into the Senate. Preston said, I'm not saying we were wrong, although some of the things we did in the early days were against the law. Barrington did not want the two of them to take up polarized positions. He intervened, saying calmly, the irony is that it proved impossible to breed perfect Americans. The whole project was on the wrong track. Natural breeding was too inexact. But we were smart enough to see the possibilities of genetic engineering.
Nobody had even heard the goddamn words back then, Jim growled as he cut into his steak.
End of side three. To continue, turn the cassette over. Slide 4. The Third Twin by Ken Follett. Continuing on page 123. Barrington nodded.
Jim's right, Preston. We should be proud of what we did, not ashamed. When you think about it, we've performed a miracle. We set ourselves the task of finding out whether certain traits, such as intelligence and aggression, are genetic. Then, identifying the genes responsible for those traits. And finally, engineering them into test-tube embryos, and we're on the brink of success.
Preston shrugged. The entire human biology community has been working on the same agenda. Not quite. We were more focused, and we placed our bets carefully. That's true. In their different ways, Barrington's two friends had let off steam. They were so predictable, he thought amiably. Maybe old friends always were. Jim had blustered and Preston had whined. Now they might be calm enough to take a cool look at the situation. That brings us back to Jeannie Farami, Barrington said. In a year or two, she may tell us how to make people aggressive without turning them into criminals. The last pieces of the jigsaw are falling into place. The Landsman takeover offers us the chance to accelerate the entire program and get Jim into the White House, too. This is no time to draw back.
That's all very well, said Preston, but what are we going to do? The Landsman Organization has a goddamn ethics panel, you know.
Barrington swallowed some snapper.
The first thing to realize is that we do not have a crisis here. We just have a problem, he said, and the problem is not Landsman. Their accountants won't discover the truth in 100 years of looking at our books. Our problem is Jeannie Farami. We have to stop her learning anything more, at least before next Monday, when we sign the takeover documents. Jim said sarcastically, But you can't order her, because it's a university, not the fucking army.
Barrington nodded. Now he had them both thinking the way he wanted. True, he said calmly. I can't give her orders. But there are more subtle ways to manipulate people than those used by the military, Jim. If you two will leave this business in my hands, I'll deal with her. Preston was not satisfied.
How?
Barrington had been turning this question over and over in his mind. He did not have a plan, but he had an idea. I think there's a problem around her use of medical databases. It raises ethical questions. I believe I can force her to stop.
She must have covered herself.
I don't need a valid reason, just a pretext.
What's this girl like? Jim said.
About 30. Tall, very athletic. Dark hair, ring in her nose. Drives an old red Mercedes. For a long time I thought very highly of her. Last night I discovered there's bad blood in the family. Her father is a criminal type.
But she's also clever, feisty, and stubborn. Married? Divorced?
Single. No boyfriend.
A dog?
No, she's a looker, but hard to handle. Jim nodded thoughtfully.
We still have many loyal friends in the intelligence community. It wouldn't be so difficult to make such a girl vanish.
Preston looked scared.
No violence, Jim. For God's sake!
A waiter cleared away their plates, and they fell silent until he had gone.
Farrington knew he had to tell them what he had learned from last night's message from Sergeant Delaware. With a heavy heart, he said, "There's something else you need to know. On Sunday night, a girl was raped in the gym. The police have arrested Steve Logan. The victim picked him out of a lineup."
Jim said,
"Did he do it?"
"No."
"Do you know who did?"
Farrington looked him in the eye. "Yes, Jim, I do." Preston said,
"Oh, shit." Jim said, "Maybe we should make the boys vanish."
Barrington felt his throat tighten up as if he were choking, and he knew he was turning red. He leaned over the table and pointed his finger at Jim's face.
"Don't you ever let me hear you say that again," he said,
jabbing his finger so close to Jim's eyes that Jim flinched, even though he was a much bigger man. Preston hissed,
"Knock it off, you two. People will see."
Barrington withdrew his finger, but he was not through yet. If they had been in a less public place, he would have got his hands around Jim's throat. Instead, he grabbed a fistful of Jim's lapel.
"We gave those boys life. We brought them into the world, good or bad. They're our responsibility." All right," Jim said. "Just understand me. If one of them is even hurt, so help me Christ, I'll blow your fucking head off, Jim."
A waiter appeared and said, "Would you gentlemen like dessert?" Barrington let go of Jim's lapel. Jim smoothed his suit coat with angry gestures.
"God damn,"
Barrington muttered.
"God damn."
Preston said to the waiter, "Bring me the check, please." 17. Steve Logan had not closed his eyes all night. Porky Butcher had slept like a baby, occasionally giving a gentle snore. Steve sat on the floor, watching him, fearfully observing every movement, every twitch, thinking about what would happen when the man woke up. Would Porky pick a fight with him? Try to rape him? Beat him up? He had good reason to tremble. Men in jail were beaten up all the time. Many were wounded, a few killed. The public outside cared nothing, figuring that if jailbirds maimed and slaughtered one another, they would be less able to rob and murder law-abiding citizens. At all costs, Steve kept telling himself, shakily, he must try not to look like a victim. It was easy for people to misread him, he knew. Tip Hendricks had made that mistake. Steve had a friendly air. Although he was big, he looked as if he would not hurt a fly. Now he had to appear ready to fight back, though without being provocative. Most of all, he should not let Porky sum him up as a clean-living college boy. That would make him a perfect target for jibes, casual blows, abuse, and finally a beating. He had to appear a hardened criminal, if possible. Failing that, he should puzzle and confuse Porky by sending out unfamiliar signals. And if none of that worked? Porky was taller and heavier than Steve, and might be a seasoned street fighter. Steve was fitter and could probably move faster, but he had not hit anyone in anger for 7 years. In a bigger space, Steve might have taken Porky out early and escaped without serious injury. But here in the cell, it would be bloody, whoever won. If Detective Alliston had been telling the truth, Porky had proved, within the last 24 hours, that he had the killer instinct. "Do I have the killer instinct?" Steve asked himself. "Is there any such thing as the killer instinct? I came close to killing Tip Hendricks. Does that make me the same as Porky?" When he thought of what it would mean to win a fight with Porky, Steve shuddered. He pictured the big man lying on the floor of the cell, bleeding, with Steve standing over him the way he had stood over Tip Hendricks, and the voice of Spike the turnkey saying, "Jesus Christ Almighty, I think he's dead." He would rather be beaten up. Maybe he should be passive. it might actually be safer to curl up on the floor and let Porky kick him until the man tired of it. But Steve did not know if he could do that. So he sat there with a dry throat and a racing heart, staring at the sleeping psychopath, playing out fights in his imagination. Fights he always lost. He guessed this was a trick the cops played often. Spike the turnkey certainly did not appear to think it unusual. Maybe, instead of beating people up in interrogation rooms to make them confess, they let other suspects do the job for them. Steve wondered how many people confessed to crimes they had not committed, just to avoid spending a night in a cell with someone like Porky. He would never forget this, he swore. When he became a lawyer, defending people accused of crimes, he would never accept a confession as evidence. He saw himself in front of a jury. I was once accused of a crime I did not commit, but I came close to confessing, he would say. I've been there. I know. Then he remembered that if he were convicted of this crime, he would be thrown out of law school and would never defend anyone at all. He kept telling himself he was not going to be convicted. The DNA test would clear him. Around midnight, he had been taken out of the cell, handcuffed, and driven to Mercy Hospital, a few blocks from police headquarters. There he had given a blood sample from which they would extract his DNA. He had asked the nurse how long the test took, and been dismayed to learn that the results would not be ready for 3 days. He had returned to the cells dispirited. He had been put back in with Porky, who was mercifully still asleep. He guessed he could stay awake for 24 hours. That was the longest they could hold him without court sanction. He had been arrested at about 6 p.m., so he could be stuck here until the same time tonight. Then, if not before, he must be given an opportunity to ask for bail. That would be his chance to get out. He struggled to recall his law school lecture on bail. The only question the court may consider is whether the accused person will show up for trial, Professor Rexham had intoned. At the time, it had seemed as dull as a sermon. Now, it meant everything. The details began to come back to him. Two factors were taken into account. One was the possible sentence. If the charge was serious, it was more risky to grant bail. A person was more likely to run away from an accusation of murder than one of petty theft. The same applied if he had a record and faced a long sentence in consequence. Steve did not have a record, although he had once been convicted of aggravated assault. That was before he was 18, and it could not be used against him. He would come before the court as a man with a clean sheet. However, the charges he faced were very grave. The second factor, he recollected, was the prisoner's community ties, family, home, and job. A man who had lived with his wife and children at the same address for 5 years and worked around the corner would get bail, whereas one who had no family in the city, had moved into his apartment 6 weeks ago, and gave his occupation as unemployed musician, would probably be refused. On this score, Steve felt confident. He lived with his parents, and he was in his second year at law school. He had a lot to lose by running away. The courts were not supposed to consider whether the accused man was a danger to the community. That would be prejudging his guilt. However, in practice, they did. Unofficially, a man who was involved in an ongoing violent dispute was more likely to be refused bail than someone who had committed one assault. If Steve had been accused of a series of rapes, rather than one isolated incident, his chances of getting bail would have been close to zero. As things stood, he thought it could go either way, and while he watched Porky, he rehearsed increasingly eloquent speeches to the judge. He was still determined to be his own lawyer. He had not made the phone call he was entitled to. He wanted desperately to keep this from his parents until he was able to say he had been cleared. The thought of telling them he was in jail was too much to bear. They would be so shocked and grieved. It would be comforting to share his plight with them, but each time he was tempted, he remembered their faces when they had walked into the precinct house 7 years ago after the fight with Tip Hendricks, and he knew that telling them would hurt him more than Porky Butcher ever could. Throughout the night, more men had been brought into the cells. Some were apathetic and compliant, others loudly protested their innocence, and one struggled with the cops and got professionally beaten up as a result. Things had quieted down around 5 o'clock in the morning. At about 8, Spike's replacement brought breakfast in styrofoam containers from a restaurant called Mother Hubbard's. The arrival of food roused the inmates of the other cells, and the noise woke Porky. Steve stayed where he was, sitting on the floor, gazing vacantly into space, but anxiously watching Porky out of the corner of his eye. Friendliness would be seen as a sign of weakness, he guessed. Passive hostility was the attitude to take. Porky sat up on the bunk, holding his head and staring at Steve. But he did not speak. Steve guessed the man was sizing him up. After a minute or two, Porky said, "The fuck you doing in here?" Steve set his face in an expression of dumb resentment, then let his eyes slide over until they met Porky's. He held his gaze for a few moments. Porky was handsome, with a fleshy face that had a look of dull aggression. He gazed speculatively at Steve with bloodshot eyes. Steve summed him up as dissipated, a loser, but dangerous. He looked away, feigning indifference. He did not answer the question. The longer it took Porky to figure him out, the safer he would be. When the turnkey pushed the food through the slit in the bars, Steve ignored it. Porky took a tray. He ate all the bacon, eggs, and toast, drank the coffee, then used the toilet noisily, without embarrassment. When he was done, he pulled up his pants, sat on the bunk, looked at Steve, and said, "What you in here for, white boy?" This was the moment of greatest danger. Porky was feeling him out, taking his measure. Steve now had to appear to be anything but what he was, a vulnerable middle-class student who had not been in a fight since he was a kid. He turned his head and looked at Porky as if noticing him for the first time. He stared hard for a long moment before answering. Slurring a little, he said, "Motherfucker started fucking me around, so I fucked him up. But good." Porky stared back. Steve could not tell whether the man believed him or not. After a long moment, Porky said,
"Murder?"
"Fucking A."
"Me too."
It seemed Porky had bought Steve's story. Recklessly, Steve added,
"Motherfucker ain't gonna fuck me around no fucking more."
"Yeah," said Porky.
There was a long silence. Porky seemed to be thinking. Eventually, he said,
"Why they put us in together?"
"They got no fucking case against me," Steve said. "They figure, if I waste you in here, they got me."
Porky's pride was touched.
"What if I waste you?" he said.
Steve shrugged.
"Then they got you."
Porky nodded, slowly.
"Yeah," he said. "Figures."
He seemed to have run out of conversation. After a while, he lay down again.
Steve waited. Was it all over?
After a few minutes, Porky seemed to go back to sleep. When he snored, Steve slumped against the wall, weak with relief. After that, nothing happened for several hours. Nobody came to speak to Steve. No one told him what was going on. There was no customer service desk where you could get information. He wanted to know when he would get the chance to ask for bail, but no one told him. He tried speaking to the new turnkey, but the man simply ignored him. Porky was still asleep when the turnkey came and opened the cell door. He fitted Steve with handcuffs and leg irons, then woke Porky and did the same to him. They were chained to two other men, taken a few steps to the end of the cell block, and ushered into a small office. Inside were two desks, each with a computer and laser printer. Before the desks were rows of gray plastic chairs. One desk was occupied by a neatly dressed black woman of about 30 years. She glanced up at them, said, "Please sit down," and continued working, tapping her keyboard with manicured fingers. They shuffled along the row of chairs and sat. Steve looked around. It was a regular office, with steel file cabinets, notice boards, a fire extinguisher, and an old-fashioned safe. After the cells, it looked beautiful. Porky closed his eyes and appeared to go back to sleep. Of the other two men, one stared with an unbelieving expression at his right leg, which was in a plaster cast, while the other smiled into the distance, plainly having no idea where he was,
seeming either high as a kite or mentally disturbed, or both. Eventually, the woman turned from her screen. "State your name," she said. Steve was first in line, so he replied. "Stephen Logan."
"Mr. Logan, I'm Commissioner Williams."
Of course. She was a court commissioner. He now remembered this part of his criminal procedure course. A commissioner was a court official, much lowlier than a judge. She dealt with arrest warrants and other minor procedural matters. She had the power to grant bail, he recalled, and his spirits lifted. Maybe he was about to get out of here. She went on.
"I'm here to tell you what you're charged with, your trial date, time, and location, whether you will have bail or be released on your own recognizance, and if released, any conditions."
She spoke very fast, but Steve picked up the reference to bail that confirmed his recollection. This was the person whom he had to persuade that he could be relied on to show up at his trial.
"You are before me on charges of first-degree rape, assault with intent to rape, battery and sodomy."
Her round face was impassive as she detailed the horrible crimes he was accused of. She went on to give him a trial date 3 weeks ahead, and he remembered that every suspect must be given a trial date not more than 30 days away.
"On the rape charge, you face life imprisonment. On the assault with intent to rape, 2 to 15 years. Both these are felonies."
Steve knew what a felony was, but he wondered if Porky Butcher did. The rapist had also set fire to the gymnasium, he recalled. Why was there no charge of arson? Perhaps because the police had no evidence directly linking him to the fire. She handed him 2 sheets of paper. One stated that he had been notified of his right to be represented. The second told him how to contact a public defender. He had to sign copies of both. She asked him a series of rapid-fire questions and keyed the answers into her computer.
"State your full name. Where do you live? And your phone number. How long have you lived there? Where did you live prior to that?"
Steve began to feel more hopeful as he told the commissioner that he lived with his parents. He was in his second year at law school, and he had no adult criminal record. She asked if he had a drug or alcohol habit, and he was able to say no. He wondered if he would get the chance to make some kind of statement appealing for bail, but she spoke fast and appeared to have a script she had to follow.
"For the charge of sodomy, I find lack of probable cause," she said.
She turned from her computer screen and looked at him.
"This does not mean that you did not commit the offense, but that there is not enough information here, in the detective's statement of probable cause, for me to affirm the charge."
She wondered why the detectives had put that charge in. Perhaps they hoped he would deny it indignantly and give himself away, saying,
"That's disgusting. I fucked her, but I didn't sodomize her. What do you think I am?"
The commissioner went on. "But you must still stand trial for the charge." Steve was confused. What was the point of her finding if he still had to stand trial? And if he, a second-year law student, found all this hard to follow, what was it like for the average person? The commissioner said,
"Do you have any questions?"
Steve took a deep breath.
"I want to apply for bail," he began. "I'm innocent,"
she interrupted him.
"Mr. Logan, you are before me on felony charges, which fall under Rule 638B of the court, which means that I, as a commissioner, cannot make a bail decision upon you. Only a judge can."
It was like a punch in the face. Steve was so disappointed he felt ill. He stared at her unbelievingly.
"Then what's the point of this whole farce?" he said angrily. "At this time, you are being held at a no-bail status."
He raised his voice.
"So why have you asked me all these questions and raised my hopes? I thought I could get out of this place."
She was unmoved.
"The information you've given me about your address and so on will be checked by a pre-trial investigator who will report to the court," she said calmly. "You go for bail review tomorrow, and the judge will make the bail decision."
"I'm being kept in a cell with him," Steve said, pointing at the sleeping Porky.
"The cells are not part of my responsibility.
The guy is a murderer. The only reason he hasn't killed me yet is that he can't stay awake. Now I'm formally complaining to you, as a court official, that I'm being mentally tortured and my life is in danger."
"When the cells are full, you have to share."
"The cells aren't full. Look out your door and you can see. Most of them are empty. They put me in with him so he would beat me up. And if he does, I'm taking action against you personally, Commissioner Williams, for letting it happen.
She softened a little. Now look into it. Now, I'm handing you some papers.
She gave him the charge summary, the probable cause statement, and several other papers.
Please sign each one and take a copy.
Frustrated and downhearted, Steve took the ballpoint she offered and signed the papers. As he was doing so, the turnkey prodded Porky and woke him up. Steve handed the papers back to the commissioner. She put them in a folder. Then she turned to Porky.
State your name.
Steve buried his head in his hands. 18. Jeannie stared at the door of the interview room as it slowly opened. The man who walked in was Stephen Logan's double. Beside her, she heard Lisa gasp. Dennis Pinker looked so like Stephen that Jeannie would never be able to tell them apart. The system worked, she thought triumphantly. She was vindicated, even though the parents vehemently denied that either of these two young men could possibly have a twin. They were as alike as her two hands. The curly, fair hair was cut the same way, short with a part. Dennis rolled the sleeves of his prison fatigues, the same neat way Stephen did the cuffs of his blue linen shirt. Dennis closed the door behind him with his heel, the way Stephen had when he had walked into Jeannie's office in Nuthouse. He gave her an engaging, boyish smile, just like Stephen's as he sat. She could hardly believe this was not Stephen. She looked at Lisa. She was staring bug-eyed at Dennis, her face pale with fear.
"It's him," she breathed.
Dennis looked at Jeannie and said, "You're going to give me your panties." Jeannie was chilled by his cool certainty, but she was also intellectually excited. Stephen would never say a thing like that. Here it was, the same genetic material transformed into two completely different individuals, one a charming college boy, the other a psychopath. But was the difference merely superficial? Robinson, the guard, said mildly, "Now behave yourself and be nice, Pinker, or you'll be in bad trouble." Dennis gave that boyish grin again, but his words were scary. "Robinson won't even know it's happened, but you'll do it," he said to Jeannie. "You'll walk out of here with a breeze blowing on your bare ass." Jeannie made herself calm. This was empty bragging. She was smart and tough. Dennis would not have found it easy to attack her, even if she had been alone. Having a tall prison guard standing next to her with a nightstick and a gun, she was perfectly safe. "Are you okay?" she murmured to Lisa. Lisa was pale, but her mouth was set in a determined line, and she said grimly, "I'm fine." Like his parents, Dennis had filled out several forms in advance. Now Lisa began on the more complex questionnaires, which could not be completed simply by ticking boxes. As they worked, Jeannie reviewed the results and compared Dennis with Stephen. The similarities were astonishing. Psychological profile, interests and hobbies, tastes, physical skills, all were the same. Dennis even had the same astonishingly high IQ as Stephen. What a waste, she thought. This young man could become a scientist, a surgeon, an engineer, a software designer. Instead, he's in here, vegetating. The big difference between Dennis and Stephen was in their socialization. Stephen was a mature man with above-average social skills, comfortable meeting strangers, prepared to accept legitimate authority, at ease with his friends, happy to be part of a team. Dennis had the interpersonal skills of a 3-year-old. He grabbed anything he wanted. He had trouble sharing. He was frightened of strangers, and if he could not get his way, he lost his temper and became violent. Jeannie could remember being 3 years old. It was her earliest memory. She saw herself leaning over the cot in which her new baby sister lay sleeping. Patty had been wearing a pretty pink sleep suit with pale blue flowers embroidered on the collar. Jeannie could still feel the hatred that had possessed her as she stared at the tiny face. Patty had stolen her mommy and daddy. Jeannie wanted with all her being to kill this intruder who had taken so much of the love and attention
previously reserved for Jeannie alone. Aunt Rosa had said, "You love your little sister, don't you?" And Jeannie had replied, "I hate her. I wish she would die." Aunt Rosa had slapped her, and Jeannie had felt doubly mistreated. Jeannie had grown up, and so had Stephen, but Dennis never had. Why was Stephen different from Dennis? Had he been saved by his upbringing? Or did he just seem different? Were his social skills no more than a mask for the psychopath beneath? As she watched and listened, Jeannie realized there was another difference. She was afraid of Dennis. She could not put her finger on the exact cause, but there was menace in the air all around him. She had the sense he would do anything that came into his head, regardless of the consequences. Stephen had not given her that feeling for one moment. Jeannie photographed Dennis and took close-ups of both ears. In identical twins, the ears were normally highly similar, especially the attachment of the earlobes. When they were almost done, Lisa took a blood sample from Dennis, something she had been trained to do. Jeannie could hardly wait to see the DNA comparison. She was certain Stephen and Dennis had the same genes. That would prove beyond doubt that they were identical twins. Lisa routinely sealed the vial and signed the seal. Then she went to put it in the cooler in the trunk of the car, leaving Jeannie to finish the interview on her own. As Jeannie completed the last set of questions, she wished she could get Stephen and Dennis in the laboratory together for a week. But that was not going to be possible for many of her twin pairs. In studying criminals, she would constantly face the problem that some of her subjects were in jail. The more sophisticated tests involving laboratory machinery would not be done on Dennis until he got out of jail, if ever. She just had to live with that. She would have plenty of other data to work with. She finished the last questionnaire. "Thank you for your patience, Mr. Pinker," she said. "You didn't give me your panties yet," he said coolly. Robinson said, "Now, Pinker, you've been good all afternoon. Don't spoil it." Dennis threw the guard a look of sheer contempt. Then he said to Jeannie, "Robinson's scared of rats. Did you know that, lady psychologist?" Suddenly, Jeannie felt anxious. There was something going on that she did not understand. She began hurriedly to tidy up her papers. Robinson looked embarrassed. "I hate rats. It's true. But I ain't scared of them." "Not even of that big gray one in the corner," Dennis said, pointing. Robinson whirled around. There was no rat in the corner, but when Robinson's back was turned, Dennis reached into his pocket and whipped out a tightly wrapped package. He moved so quickly that Jeannie did not guess what he was doing until it was too late. He unfolded a blue-spotted handkerchief to reveal a fat gray rat with a long pink tail. Jeannie shuddered. She was not squeamish, but there was something profoundly creepy about seeing the rat cupped lovingly in the hands that had strangled a woman. Before Robinson could turn around again, Dennis had released the rat. It ran across the room. "There, Robinson! There!" Dennis cried. Robinson turned around, saw the rat, and paled. "Shit!" he growled, and he drew his nightstick. The rat ran along the floor molding, looking for somewhere to hide. Robinson went after it.